Dear friends in Christ Jesus, I first of all wish to bring greetings to you from the missionaries and members of the India Evangelical Lutheran Church. Special greetings I bring to the staff and students of this world-famous institution, from the staff and students of Concordia Seminary in India. Just at the time of my departure to here, I was specially asked by the staff and students there to carry their greetings to you. So I have very great pleasure in bringing warm greetings from the staff and students of the seminary in India to one and all of you. The subject on which I wish to speak to you this morning is IELC, its problems and its opportunities. IELC stands, as you know, for the India Evangelical Lutheran Church. It is the youngest national church that has been organized in India. It came into being only last year. The mission of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, the latest mission to enter India, brought the gospel to us in 1895. As a result of the 65 years of mission work, we now have a national church. No other mission in India established a national church in such a short period as the Missouri Mission. IELC is moreover the first national church to be organized in the mission field of the Missouri Mission, of the Missouri Church. A few statistical figures of our church may interest you. The work in the IELC is carried on in 8 languages. We have a baptized membership of 30,500. We have 300 congregations, 114 native pastors, 45 missionaries, 8 secondary schools, 90 primary schools, a hospital, a few dispensaries, and a teacher training school. Now, what are some of the problems that the IELC is facing today as a national church? I can perhaps first of all mention our financial problem. This financial problem is by no means our biggest problem. But I wish to mention this first because we were somehow, our whole attention was somehow drawn to this problem at the time of the formation of our national church last year. With the formation of the church, a 5% annual cut in the foreign subsidy was introduced. This 5%, which is about $8,000, may seem to be a very small amount to you, but it is not. How big this amount is to the national church, to the newly organized national church, you will understand if you know that the total contribution of the IELC last year was only $12,000. And our foreign subsidy was $160,000. So you see the difference between the $12,000 which we contribute and the $160,000 which we get from the Mother Church. Now, one third of this heavy subsidy is used up for our educational institutions. Now this creates an immediate question. How to run our educational institutions at a 5% cut? There is only one thing we can do about it. Either we should try to maintain our schools as the other churches are doing in India, that is by getting government aid, or we should close down our institutions. But we hate to close down our good institutions, especially our Lutheran schools have a name and a fame in South India. So we don't want to close our schools. So we have applied for almost all our schools, we have applied for government aid. But we do not know if we are going to get government aid. First of all, our government has no money just now. And secondly, the government of India, as a government, does not want to encourage Christian schools anymore. At one time they did, but they don't do it anymore, and they are not going to do it anymore. This is our financial problem. Although it is a big problem for the newly organized church, we are not bitter about it. We are not going to ask the Foreign Mission Board to withdraw the 5% cut. We are going to face it. We want to face it because we want to become self-supporting. The church's stability, as you know, depends in a very large measure on the attainment of independence, both in terms of finance and personnel. As a second problem, I can perhaps mention the problem of national leadership. National leadership is a great need of every newly organized national church. Just now, this is one of our problems because we do not have enough qualified leaders, qualified both spiritually and as well as intellectually, to take up the many administrative posts of the church, to be theological teachers in our seminary, and to produce Christian literature. The problem is this, that we are not going to have them unless the church does something to produce them or make them. It is true that leaders are given and not made, but all the same, the church has got to find the prospective and promising young men, give them the necessary higher education, and train them to become leaders of the church. Leadership training is therefore one of the most important tasks which a foreign missionary has got to undertake in the national church today. We need missionaries to guide us and to lead us in carrying on the work of the church. We need missionaries today to organize and conduct lay training institutes and workshops. We need missionaries today to change the attitude of our people and workers from the idea of a served church to a serving church. Some people nowadays seem to think that the work of the foreign missionary is over in India. I would say that they are not right in saying so. The work of the missionary has just begun in India. But it is very unfortunate that just at a time when we need missionaries the most, their entry into India is very much restricted by our government. But the government has not closed the door for foreign missionaries. It is still possible to get them. There are more foreign missionaries in India today than there were 10 years ago. There are 5,000 foreign missionaries working in India. It is up to the national church to show to the government the dire need for a particular missionary or missionaries, and the IELC is always ready to do that and is doing that. Secondly, national leadership will increase also with foreign education. Some of our educated students and pastors and teachers should have the benefit of Western theology and learning. They should be brought here to America so that their horizon may be widened and that they may get into closer touch with the older churches of the West. The problem of evangelism is one of our greatest problems. Only 2% of the population of India is Christian. It is estimated that 1/4 of the population has not yet even heard the gospel. There are so many castes in India, but the Christian church has so far touched only a few of them. While much has been done to the underprivileged, the intelligentsia in India remain unchallenged by our Christian message. And then there are the 4 million Orthodox and fanatic Muslims as our neighbors. What an enormous task it is for the Indian church. But to know how enormous it really is, how enormous the task really is, we should know how active the non-Christian religions are in India. Hinduism is no more a dead religion. It was once thought to be a dead religion, but it is no more a dead religion. A deputation of a religious association of Hindus presented a memorandum to the Commissioner of Hindu Religious Endowments in Madras 2 years ago, making several requests to the government. This memorandum denotes significant trends of thought among Hindus about propagation of Hinduism. The memorandum says, among other things, "We therefore pray that sufficient funds should be set apart by all well-to-do temples, one, for the purpose of a better organization of the recitations of Tevarams and Divya Prabandhams," they are the names for the songs of Hinduism, "two, for the arrangement of lectures for elucidating the meaning of the sutras and songs and explaining the fundamentals of Hindu religion and religious worship, and three, for the effective organization of congregational worship, as a part of which religious sermons may be delivered by great religious teachers and scholars." This is the memorandum. The suggestions made here in this memorandum are all being put into practice today in India. Hindu theological schools and colleges are being opened in a number of places. Hindu religious lecture halls and meeting places are being built in all big cities and towns. Hindu swamis no more sit in their mutts, but they travel around to all places in their jurisdiction giving lectures on Hinduism. Religious talks are given every day in the temple worship. Sunday schools are being organized. Hindu women's organizations are being formed. They are spending their time and money in social service and in establishing orphanages. The so-called Hindu missions are working vigorously to reconvert Christians by openly offering material help. Hindu literature publishing houses are springing up in all big centers, and hundreds of thousands of dollars are being spent for the production of Hindu literature with the sole purpose of counteracting the influence of Christian literature. There is a mutt called Benares Religious Mutt. Mutt is the name of a religious society in India. That religious society recently donated $100,000 for the production of Hindu literature. And a suggestion is that each of the five such religious societies should donate $100,000. If they do, and they can do it, they will have $500,000 just for the production of Hindu literature. How much is the whole Indian church is spending for literature is a very, very poor amount, poor figure. Some 10 years ago, I traveled from Bangalore. When I traveled from Bangalore to Mysore, I saw a few temples on the roadside in a dilapidating condition. But when I traveled the same way last year, I was surprised to see that those few dilapidating temples were not only renovated, but there were half a dozen new temples built in this period of 10 years. Now, this is Hinduism of today. Then there are some reactionary political parties in India, like the Hindu Mahasabhas and the so-called RSS, Rashtra Swayam Sevak Sangh. Their one aim is to create a Hindu Raj, that is, a kingdom of Hinduism. They think that someday Christianity will be absorbed in Hinduism and that there will be one kingdom, which will be a kingdom of Hinduism. That is their one aim, and they are trying to do their best. They are trying to work towards that goal. They always do that. A great love for Buddhism has recently been created among some of the backward communities in India. Several thousands of them were recently converted to Buddhism when their leader, Dr. Ambedkar, he is no more now, he is dead, when he became a Buddhist. Such are the religions that the Christian church has got to face today. So you see what a great challenge it is for the Indian church to preach the gospel to her non-Christian neighbors. We also have a problem concerning the question of church union. We have been having for some years now doctrinal discussions and conferences, not only with our other Lutheran brethren in India, but also with the Church of South India. Our discussions with the Federation of Evangelical Lutheran Churches has resulted in the adoption of a doctrinal statement. And our conversation with the CSI has so far resulted in three agreed statements, namely law and gospel, election, and Lord's Supper. We are continuing our conversations with them. The CSI Lutheran Joint Theological Commission is meeting today in Bangalore. They are meeting since yesterday and are discussing the subject of the church's ministry. They'll have a meeting till tomorrow. So I request you all to remember this conference between the Church of South India, between the representatives of the Church of South India and the Lutherans in your prayers. Now in all these deliberations, we have been convinced of the guidance of the Holy Spirit. It is really surprising to see what measure of theological agreement has come forth from these meetings. But the question is, from here on, where do we go? Suppose we arrive at an agreed statement also with the question of the ministry of the church with the CSI. What is the next step that we are going to take? What next can be taken? What steps should be taken? What is the place of confessional unity and denominational loyalty in such a situation? These are not questions that can be easily answered. We in the National Church do not have any ready-made answers for these questions. But these questions have got to be faced, and answers have got to be found sooner or later. Here we need the sympathetic understanding and the help of our brethren in the faith. There is one more problem which I will briefly refer to, that is the greatest of all our problems. We all know what it is. The greatest problem in a church is ourselves. We are the problem number one in our churches. We especially, as members of the newly organized National Church, know our weaknesses and failings. Never before we realized how much we have got to grow in Christian faith and Christian life, and how much we have got to go in unselfish and devoted service to the Lord and His church, and how much we lack in the missionary zeal for preaching the gospel to our own countrymen, than now when we have taken over on our shoulders the work of the church. But man's extremity is God's opportunity. What are some of the opportunities that we have in the newly organized church? The formation of the National Church has taken place at a significant time in the history of the nation. We got our independence in 1947. Since then, revolutionary changes are taking place in India. The age-long caste system is breaking down. Untouchability has been made illegal. This opens up a new door to witnessing to caste Hindus. People are becoming dissatisfied with their traditional ways of life and worship. A spirit of inquiry is really abroad everywhere in India. So the very resurgence of non-Christian religions is more an opportunity to the National Church than it is a problem. Then there is more respect for Christ and His teachings today shown by the Hindus than ever before in the life of the nation. Pictures of Jesus can be seen hung on the walls of public places and even in some Brahmin hotels. Christian songs are heard on the radio very often. Christian dramas and cinemas are always eagerly awaited, not by Christians so much, but by non-Christians and especially by Brahmins. They want to see the picture of Jesus. They want to see Jesus on the cross. We always like to see that, wish to see that. Non-Christian periodicals publish special Christmas and Easter numbers. All these things were unheard of only a few years ago. Then the Constitution of the Republic of India grants us the freedom the freedom to profess, practice, and to propagate the Christian faith. So every citizen in India has the right of conversion. There is general friendliness on the part of our leading statement towards the Christian Church. They recognize what Christian missions have done and what they can still do for India in the fields of education, social service, health, and economic uplift. A great interest in evangelistic work is being awakened in our lay people. One of the activities of almost every one of our youth societies in India is to go out to villages, to neighboring villages, and preach the gospels there to the people of all castes. Since the old rigid rules of caste distinction are breaking down, our lay people go to any caste street, stand there, sit at their houses, and preach the gospel. Sometimes these high caste people will also supply a table or a chair or a stool or a bench if they need for any program of picture showing. Years ago, our people did not entertain the idea of self-support so much. But today it is not so. Especially, our young people are always mindful, are always conscious of becoming a self-supporting church. They are no more afraid of the idea of self-support. So these are some of our opportunities to preach the gospel to the millions of non-Christian population in India. We have great many problems to face, but we have many more opportunities to preach the gospel. In fact, all the problems we enumerated just now are unique opportunities for us Christians to preach the gospel to our Hindu and Muslim friends and neighbors and also relatives. God has really set an open door before us. This is God's hour for the IELC, for the church in India as a whole. Is the IELC conscious of these many problems and opportunities and open doors? Is the IELC willing and ready to take over these God-given responsibilities and make use of the open doors? Is she equipped spiritually, mentally, and financially for this great task laid on her? Yes, it is, because of the promise of the power of the Holy Spirit and because the Lord of the Church is vitally concerned about the salvation of each and every soul in India. In conclusion, one more word. We speak of national churches, but let us not forget the fact that the Christian church is never national, but it is universal. The church in India is a part of the world church, We can never forget the universal character of the Christian faith. Therefore, even when we become a self-supporting and self-governing church, we would still want to have missionaries from the older churches with us as fraternal workers. The future is in the safe and good hands of the Lord of the church and of the universe, that we know. And we also know that as far as the present is concerned, the Western Church can still stand by the side of the younger churches. The door of India is still wide open for the preaching of the sweet gospel of our Savior Jesus Christ. Let both the younger and older churches seize this opportunity and make the best use of it. Amen.
There is still some time left. If anyone would like to address any questions to Pastor Jacalia, they'll be willing to try to answer them.
Yes, some Christians have gone back to Hinduism, but there are very few people. The majority of the Christians remain faithful to their Lord and to the Church. And it is so wonderful to see how the message of the gospel has taken hold of their hearts, that in spite of the fact that material benefits, employment, free education, and even college education is freely given to the low caste people, our people still remain with the church. Only very few people here and there have gone back to Hinduism, but some of them are coming back again. Thank you for the question. I wish I had more time to touch upon that problem also, but to tell you the fact, communism is yet not a very big problem to the church. But it is becoming a problem because out of the 14 states in the Republic of India, we have one communist state. And one of our three synods is within this communist state called Kerala. That's becoming a problem. But we feel that communism cannot thrive so well in India as it did in some of the other countries of the world. However, that is really a problem, and our young people, especially in Kerala, are influenced by the communist ideas. And we are having some trouble in the Trivandrum Synod as a result of that. But we are trying to solve that problem.
Right over here, and then
our Christians in the church come from the low class people. That means from the low economic standard. So naturally their giving capacity is very low. But in spite of the poverty stricken condition of our people, they have learned to give, and they are giving to the church. Very often they're giving their contribution has to come from their food money. But they do give, and they are going to give more. So that's why I emphasize the fact that we are not going to ask the Foreign Mission Board to withdraw the cut, because we want to save it, and we are going to improve in our giving. But with regard to the other caste people, you know, most of them are in a better economic condition. And there, some of them are very rich. So they can afford to contribute large amounts. That really makes a difference. And moreover, they are 98% of the population. We are only 2%. And in the whole of India, there are 360 million people in India, and most of them are Hindus. There are five religious societies, so each religious society can raise any amount they want to, any time. They have no difficulty. They have plenty of money in the temple. If they only take out the money that they have, the gold and silver and the money they have in the temple, and they are trying to do this now, they'll have an enormous amount of money in their hands.
Mr. Barrett.
Well, I would say yes. But there, you know, the condition is different. The candidates for this seminary training are selected by the church, by the congregation. And they are selected especially from among our workers, from among our teachers and evangelists. So we have not come to the position where students apply for theological training. Perhaps someday we will get to that position also, I think. And another thing may interest you, the students at the seminary, theological seminaries, are paid. Salaries are given to them. Because they are selected from among our workers who have been receiving salaries before they came to the seminary, they continue with the same salary after they come to the seminary.
Yes.
There are 10 other Lutheran church bodies in India. We have nearly 500,000 Lutherans, or more than 500,000 Lutherans in India. And there is a Federation of Evangelical Lutheran Church in which all the 10, all other 10 Lutherans are members. You are more or less right. Although, I should say this, our relationship there with the other Lutherans is better. Well, the average income of a person in India is about $50, not per day, per week, or per month, per year. $50 per year. So you can understand where the Indian people stand with regard to standard of life. They are really in a very poverty-stricken condition. If you take an average congregation, about one-fifth of the people in that congregation will have sufficient food to eat. And about four-fifths of the people will have difficulty getting their daily meals. Either they will have one meal a day, or two insufficient meals. They may get a few cents as their wage for the day, and out of that few cents they must buy rice, they must buy some vegetables and a few other things to satisfy the hunger of the parents and the children. But when they come to church service on Sunday, no one of them will come empty-handed. They will always bring their offering. And then, in spite of the fact that they do not have sufficient rice to eat to fill their stomach, every day the lady, the woman, will take one handful of rice from the rice that she is going to cook for the meal and preserve it in a small tin. They do that every time they cook their rice. And then every week, on Sunday morning when they go to church, they take along this tin full of rice to the church. That is the offering from the woman for the church. We call this rice collection. And at the end of the year, that collection amounts to something. And in so many other ways, people in India contribute. But at the same time, we always feel that they can still do better, that they can still give more. Surely it is giving from their poverty, but still they can give. And we are hoping that they will do. And one more thing I must say here, with the so many five-year plans that our nation is working with, we are hoping that the average income of a person in India will increase after 5 or 10 years. And then our contributions also will naturally increase. So we are hoping for better days in India.
I think this should come to all of us. I hear in the States, we think about this. We complain about giving some, I think it should really make us stop and think one. Are there any more questions to be suggested to Pastor Tyler? Sam?
Thank you. No, my answer is no to that question. If this had come from 10 years ago, perhaps people would have resented that. But today, it is not the case. Although it is a very big burden on the Young National Church to take over such a big financial burden, still people want to take it. They are not grumbling about it. No, they are very grateful that the Mother Church supported them all these years, and that they are still supporting them. They are grateful that they had introduced a cut of only 5%, and that they are grateful that they have given 20-year period to become a self-supporting church. It is not a very hard and fast rule, of course, because they are always willing to reconsider any special requests that would come from the Indian church. So people are very grateful for what the Mother Church has been doing and is doing today.
Yes?
Do you feel that the higher standard of living that you think by our missionaries in India over the populace has entered the working race among the people?
Well, there is so much talk about this question among the scholars, among the students of missions, no doubt. But a person who lives right in India and who sees how the rich people of India are living, how luxurious a life they are leading, I don't think it makes much difference to see a missionary living in a nice bungalow and having a car and things like that. You see, we used to think that missionaries lead a very luxurious life in India. But last week, I wrote some letters to some of our leaders, national leaders in India, and I wrote to them, I tried to make one point in that letter. I wrote to them that it is a pity that we think that missionaries live a luxurious life in India, because when I compare the life that an average American leads here in the States, their life in India is nothing. The life of a missionary, comparatively speaking. So, it all depends, you know. Comparing the standard of the people with the standard of the missionaries, of course, there is a big difference. But as far as they themselves are concerned, and when we compare them with the middle class of people, or the rich class of people in India, they're not leading a very luxurious life. However, there is a point in this that the big difference between the standard of living has something to do, no doubt. And that's a question that cannot be answered immediately, I think. There's a question for study. I would rather put it like that. Personally, I'm not prepared to say anything definitely on that question. I think it's a question that should be studied. People have been talking about this matter, but no change has taken place so far. So there is something to be studied, I think. You mean with reference to the nationals?
Yes.
Well, if we get the right type of men to come here, I don't think we'll have any difficulty. Our church especially has had that fear rather a bit too much, and they abstained from sending any of our nationals to America until now. I am the first man to be brought here by our mission. But the other churches have always been sending men, their teachers or doctors and pastors to Western countries for more theological or professional training. And they have been benefited to a large extent by that type of a program of higher education. Now, I wish to tell you that today, now this is not a complaint against the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod or against the Foreign Mission Board, but I wish to bring to your notice that we do not have even one theologian in our church. I mean, we do not have one person whom we can call really a theologian, who could stand on his legs and speak in conferences and in other meetings with other churches. I have had the opportunity of attending a number of conferences, such inter-church conferences, and usually from our church there will be only one Indian, and most of the other representatives will be Americans, will be missionaries. But it is not so with the other churches. More Indian representatives used to come to attend these conferences. So there is a difference, and that's why I emphasize that fact that we, as a national church, in order to increase our national leadership, we need foreign education. And there is no danger involved in that if we pick the right type of men to come here.
I think we have time for one more question. Pastor Powell will be around on campus. If you have some more questions, I'd like to direct to him while you have plenty of time to do that then. Rudy, did you have your hand up before?
I'd like to ask to what extent do our Hindu Christians participate in life?
Thank you for the question. It's an interesting question. We are not cut off from our national life. Some 10 or 15 years ago, that is before independence, we were somewhat isolated. We stand aloof from the national affairs. We thought that that is not our business, but it is not so today. Especially our young people are very much interested in the national life of the church, and they are taking part in all national activities. And we are encouraging them to do so.
Thank you very much, Pastor Kaya, for alerting us to the problems of ILC and also to the opportunities which the Lord has opened up to us there. I'm very happy to have you around our campus as a member of our seminary family. We hope that the Lord will continue to bless you in your work and your visit here in the States, and also in your work in return back to India. I think this stimulating talk this morning should encourage all of us to remember our brethren in our prayers and think of them in their work in India. Thank you very much for coming. This will conclude our convocation.